Welcome to episode 49 of the Pirate Monk Podcast. 49, can you believe it, Aaron?
4 plus 9 equals 13.
All right, Rain Man.
Okay, you got that. I was going to only drive in the driveway on Tuesdays. I didn't even have to go there. Wow. You're sharp this morning, and it's early. Yeah, guys, it's the beard. It's made you smarter.
It's 6 a.m. in his time right now.
So. That's it. Well, welcome, everybody. I'm your host, Nate Larkin, here high above the Mellow Mushroom in metropolitan Franklin, Tennessee, with our fearless engineer, Mondo Grimes, joining us from the opposite side of the continent where the sun has not yet risen. Has it? Has it risen yet?
Oh, no. There's no rising.
Aaron Orlando Porter.
I got you the middle name this morning.
That's right.
Hola.
You can't say nothing to that, man.
That's right. I tell you. Kinda,
there were so many things I could have said, Mondo, that they were all crowded around my mouth, and none of them could make it out.
Well, I got to tell you, Aaron, we braved blizzard conditions to make it into to Studio A here today. It is. Yeah. This is wrong. This should not happen south of the Mason-Dixon line.
You ain't lying.
Un-freaking believable.
Yeah.
I almost didn't get in yesterday from San Antonio, where I was for the weekend. I was afraid I was going to get snowed in down at the Alamo. But we got in. Anyway.
Yeah, I saw Allie's pictures of your yard from your bedroom window, which was amazing. That's the closest I'll ever get to going in the secret room.
Yes, it is.
She's got She let a little peek for all of us who have been curious what lies behind that door. So
Allie's got a sign on the door that goes up to the master suite that says nobody gets in to see the wizard. Not nobody. Not no way. That's right.
Yep, and the sign has been respected. I don't know anyone but you who has gone up to that room.
Yeah.
So how was the weekend? You were with Buddy Green, yeah?
Yeah, I was with Buddy Green and down at Laity Lodge in Lakey, Texas. Man, what a fantastic place. You know, Buddy said you have to drive through a river to get there.
Mm-hmm. Seriously?
Yeah, you don't drive across the river.
Through it.
You drive up the river.
Oh, really?
The river is the road.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. And just spectacular. Wow. What a fantastic place. And Buddy was there.
That seems like really bad planning to make a river a road. Couldn't they have just put it on either side of the river?
No. It's sheer canyon walls. The only way to get in is to go up the canyon.
I was going to say, only Christians would engineer in that way. Let's make it as difficult as possible to get to the conference center. But, okay, there seems to be some rocky reasons. Go on. So tell us more about the weekend.
Buddy brought world-class talent with him. He brought Jeff Taylor, a multi-talented musician, best known, I think, for his accordion work. He plays with Elvis Costello and does session work all over town. And then Ron Block, banjo virtuoso, member of Station Inn, plays with Alison Krauss. He was there. You know, and it was 50 guys at the retreat. The guys did a concert on Saturday night, I guess. And man, we just had some wonderful worship. And that group of guys, almost all of them from Texas, really zeroed in on the teaching that I was able to bring. Cool. It was a marvelous, marvelous time. I can't recommend that place highly enough. If you're in the Lone Star State or anywhere near it, actually people come from all over the world to go to Laity Lodge. What a wonderful retreat center.
Well, awesome. Glad to have you back. Glad you made it in through the snow. Well done.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
And looking forward to taking off again, brother. I looked at the extended weather forecast. They're calling for a high of 75 degrees in San Diego when we get there in a few days.
Nice. A few days, really?
Yeah.
It's already. Wow.
I'm coming early.
You're scaring me again.
Yeah. We're going to get there early and avoid you for a week or so, and then meet up with you in the with the pastors up in the mountains.
Very good. What's too early to be offended? I feel fine. Thank you to all the listeners whose hearts went out to me with that cruelty, that cruel jab to my heart.
Yes. How about your weekend, Aaron? What went down out there in the happiest place on earth, San Luis Obispo, California?
Yeah.
Wow, I have a lot of trouble remembering back once the week gets
try
started.
Try remembering ahead. Go ahead.
No, I'm thinking. You just kind of talk until I remember what happened.
You know,
was this a holiday weekend?
Well, yeah, I do. You did have a show, right? Because you called me right before.
Oh, right. We were Jack in the Box. Yes.
Yeah.
This is a busy musical week.
You're playing Jack in the Boxes now.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You walked into that, man.
I know.
We're encouraging the workers there through music to stop peeing in the malt machine. So it's a ministry.
Okay.
Yeah. It is a busy musical week. It is always good to have three shows in a week just to remind myself why I don't do this for a living.
Yes.
It is one of those weeks, but it was fun. We got to do a mostly college service in the next town over, and it's just such a fun age group to hang out with because they want to be pushed like no other age group.
So we
just had a good time amidst some fun technical difficulties, which is typical, but that always makes it more interesting and makes it more live. So
sure,
it was good.
If you can incorporate screaming feedback into the song, it works out
well. Well, luckily, I only play the death metal, so it works fine.
How about you and the Grimes Clan over there, Mondo?
The Grimes Clan, man, we had a pretty busy weekend.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of church stuff, you know. Bridal showers, bachelor parties.
Oh, wow.
We have some friends of ours, you know, getting married in 2 weeks. So
okay.
This was the go hang out. The girls go over there in the corner. Guys go in this corner.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I was wondering why you had that glitter on your face left over from. So that explains it. Thank you.
Yeah, man. So it's a pretty busy weekend, man. It was good, though. We just did all that stuff with family and friends and all of our friends and getting married and kind of all the hustle and bustle of that.
Yeah.
You know, and then all day at church.
Okay.
Yesterday. Or was that yesterday? Or I don't even know what day it is.
No, you know what?
See, thank you, Mondo. You've validated my existence.
Yeah, exactly. 2 days ago? Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, we got a great podcast coming up. We're gonna pull out a new segment called the Samson Mini Meeting.
Mini Meeting.
And we've
Mini
got,
Meeting.
Yeah, and we've got a return guest.
Yes, we do.
It took a long time and excruciating negotiations with his agent.
Yes.
And required the payment of vast amounts of money.
Has definitely increased since the last visit.
Yeah. But he flew in from Lisbon last night to be with us today.
And he's brought some great information with him.
Yeah, yeah.
I just thought we ran out of people we knew and we were cycling back through. I wasn't supposed to.
You weren't supposed to say that.
Okay, go on, Lisbon. We were.
And we will be right back on the Pirate Monk podcast.
I've never been too good with words. Nothing ever comes out right. Just for you, I'll speak my mind. Say what I'm feeling inside.
Welcome back to the Pirate Monk Podcast. We have a new segment we're going to introduce with this show.
Mm-hmm.
We're at least going to give it a trial run. We'll see if it flies.
Right.
We don't have any special music for it, anything like that. No fancy graphics here on the podcast. But we're going to call it the Samson Mini Meeting.
The Samson Mini Meeting.
Yes.
Okay, so here's the idea.
Mm-hmm.
For those of our listeners who are not able to attend the meeting,
mm-hmm.
or for those who are able to attend one meeting a week but they just like a second one, we're gonna do a taste. We're just gonna do a little bit of sharing. We're gonna pick a topic and talk honestly out of our own experience. We'll introduce it with the standard reading from the meeting format. Have you got that, Aaron?
We have now reached the sharing portion of our podcast. In sharing, we speak honestly out of our own experience. We tell the truth about ourselves, knowing that our brothers will listen to us in love and hold whatever we say in strictest confidence and not share the podcast with anyone. We try to keep our comments brief, taking care to... I see that there's some things in here that doesn't quite fit, but...
Yeah, right, there are some limitations to this.
We
right.
try to keep our comments brief, taking care to leave plenty of time for others. We address our statements to the group as a whole, rather than directing them toward any one person, Nate. As a rule, we refrain from giving advice to other people or instructing them during the meeting, believing that such conversations are best reserved for private moments between friends. The suggested topic today is... insecurity. Ooh. But we're not confined to that subject, although we will be for this purpose. You may speak about any issue that's currently commanding your attention. So, insecurity.
Insecurity.
Well, whose idea was this to do the mini meeting? Was this yours, Nate?
It was, actually.
Okay, yeah. Then you start.
Okay, I will. I'm Nate.
Mm-hmm. Hello, Nate.
Hi, Nate.
Ah, see, that's how I get the floor in the SAMHSA meeting. For those of you who don't know. Insecurity. I was taught from an early age never to let them see you sweat. My father had this, I suppose if he were Latin we'd call it machismo. But he had a cockiness about him, a confidence about him. And I never suspected as a kid that there was anything artificial about it. All I knew was that my dad knew he could do anything. And he just, sometimes he had a habit of going on the offensive in almost any confrontation. He wasn't a guy ever to back down. And that's part of how masculinity was defined for me. Never let him back you down. Never let him see you sweat. I know that it's not right of me to blame my dad for the whole deal. But however it went down, I adopted that as a part of my persona. Part of my self-concept, and certainly a major part of my public self. I didn't want anybody to suspect that I was deeply insecure. I was, and to a certain degree remain, however, deeply insecure. And that's why I desperately need... I need the fellowship of friends who actually know me, who can dig in underneath the persona, who can see my weakness and my fear, and who nonetheless can remind me of who I am, and sometimes can carry me. I don't always have to carry myself or carry them. To me, the price of real friendship is admitting my insecurity. Mm-hmm. Until I could admit that I was insecure, I really didn't have any true friends because I never brought my true self to the conversation. And I wouldn't let anybody help me because a part of my persona was I always had to be the helper. It was a big part of being a pastor for me. I was the answer guy in those 5 years that I was in pastoral ministry. And I could help others through grief because I really didn't grieve myself. I could help others through confusion because I was never confused. The truth is quite different. I'm often confused today. There is a lingering sadness that haunts me. I do still have an annoying habit of comparing myself with other people and then judging my worth on the basis of that evaluation. There's a part of me still that wants to be the smartest or the most articulate guy in the room. I still rank myself with others in terms of accomplishment and income and possessions. I want to be seen as a success, and I put the weight of myself on, you know, however I see myself to be competing in a competitive world. Now, that's foolish to do, and it's a pattern that I would love to escape from. I'm not as bound to it as I used to be, but I'm still tied to it, and I'm kidding myself if I pretend otherwise. So, you know, in the words of Kris Kristofferson, I guess freedom is another word for nothing left to lose. There is a joy that comes from walking away from reputation. There's a freedom when, in those fleeting moments when I'm not in competition with anybody else, when the security comes not from when there's a security in knowing who I am, I don't know, I grab it sometimes and then it slips away. Can't get real specific right now on something as widely available as this podcast, but I certainly have found a direction that I should pursue with my Silas. I'll stop there. Thanks.
Thanks, Nate.
Thanks, Nate. I'm Aaron.
Yeah. Hey, Aaron.
It's interesting listening to you, Nate, because I feel like I'm coming from the exact opposite place, where early on I was partly how I was wired and partly how I just kind of grew up. I became an idealist. So as long as I had the right answer and knew it was right, I didn't have to feel insecure. I could just walk into it. If everybody thought I was wrong, it only proved I was right. If they killed me for it, irrefutably right. So it's a no-lose situation as long as you've got the answer. And then to go be a pastor, that's just a very convenient place to be an idealist, because you can make sure everybody knows you're right. You can always dispense the right answer. And I think there's a certain level of insecurity that's really healthy for me that I'm coming to in my life, where right answers have not simply produced the results I thought they would. That my inner idealist really believed I could just plug in answers and I would pull out a product when the microwave dinged. And what I found is there's as much pain after the right answers as after the wrong answers sometimes. And so all that's left is surrender. And I think that's, honestly, the word insecurity for me makes me feel hopeful of a little more of the death of the idealist who can't just cookie cutter it but has to surrender, even if I believe in the answer that I'm living, because I can't control what's going to happen next, and I got to trust God with that. So that's what I feel about that word.
Thanks, Aaron.
Thanks, Aaron.
Wow, good stuff.
Well, I'm Mondo.
Hey, Mondo.
Hey, Mondo.
Insecurity for me, that's something that really wasn't discussed, or even something in a culture I grew up in that was not anything you tapped into or talked about. It was that thing, if something's not, you're not feeling good about something, walk it off. Mm. You know, put some dirt on it. You know, that culture, you know, man up.
Mm-hmm.
And it created this, I believe, looking back, another person. It was half of me, which is not the truth, because it's not all of me. And even to today, working on being 100% vulnerable about the things I'm insecure about. So it's almost like a twofold for me. It's vulnerability to talk about the insecurity. And in all aspects of life, whether it be performance at work, whether it be personal struggles, whether it be marital struggles and issues, whether decisions and regrets of the past or whatever it may be, it's being able to actually look at it, talk about it, versus say, yeah, it's over there in the corner. I'll deal with it when I get to it. Or walk it off. And the further I've tried to walk away from looking at the insecurities, I realize when I look back, it's still there. It doesn't go anywhere. And so I think for me, insecurity is a big ball of wax. I'm finding how much better I feel when I do discuss it with my friends and family. And when growing up, I was the savior of the family. I'm the strong guy. When something happens and all hell breaks loose, I'm the guy you call. I'm the fix it dude. Mr. Know-it-all, so to speak. I'm that guy. So it's interesting because I was the one guy in the family that wasn't allowed to do it because everybody was coming to me. If there was weakness shown from my perspective, then something's really wrong. Imagine running to Christ and he's like, you know what, I can't talk right now, I'm feeling really insecure. I mean, you know what I'm saying? And not saying that I am that to my family, but I was positioned, so I think the environment of my family and friends growing up and through a lot of my adulthood created this wall of protection to say, you know what, I can't let anybody see that stuff because then they will really know that I'm not as strong as they think I am. I don't know as much as they think I do. I can't help them as much as they think I can help. And, man, I don't want them to know that. So then you have the vulnerability. So insecurity is definitely something that, for me, it's a daily grind. It's a process, but I have found that what's encouraged that is community with brothers and with sisters, community with friends and family, and going back and talking to family that helped position me where I am and saying, hey, you know what, let's talk. I want to tell you a story. Let me tell you what I was really thinking back when that happened. And I found that's brought healing as well, to revisit some of those things that I've left in the corner and act like it was going to tend to itself and has not. So I think going back, piece by piece, and really looking at it and talking about it and being vulnerable is actually helped the relationship with those people more than me hiding. Me being more open and vulnerable has actually enhanced and enriched our relationship in that community more than anything I thought I was doing previously. So then you have that, wow, I was stupid, why didn't I do this all along? But when something's so ingrained, it becomes challenging to just have it be second nature. So it's definitely a daily walk. So I'll stop there.
Thanks, Mondo. And we'll be back on the Pirate Monk Podcast.
Welcome back to the Pirate Monk Podcast, episode 49. It is a Tuesday morning here on the West Coast, but joining us much later and colder.
Oh, yeah, it's Wednesday here in Tennessee.
Okay. I did hear the pole was shifting. I didn't know that it shifted that much. Yeah. We've actually moved the time zone.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a special guest, special enough to be brought back a second time. Thaddeus, welcome back. You are our favorite therapist. And
thank you.
And I love that you bring in topics that nobody else would want to talk about, because it's a scary mm-hmm. topic mm-hmm. in our Christian world. So give us a little introduction, or Nate, do you
want to let me jump in. I got to tell you, it's been, 9 months since you were on the show?
About, I think.
Yeah.
Thank you for having me.
And that episode called Samson and Same-Sex Attraction has gotten an awful lot of play, and we've seen great fruit coming from it. You lit a torch of hope that's already made a world of difference, Thaddeus. So you're a world changer guy. You really you make a huge difference in our local community here, and now the Lord's using you really not just across the country but around the globe, because you're not willing to talk about some of those areas of sexuality that Christians find it very, very difficult to discuss.
Yeah.
So the name for what the most of what you do, Thaddeus, first of all, tell us, our longtime listeners know, but go ahead and tell us where you're practicing and who you're practicing with.
Okay.
And and then describe for us kind of the general thrust of the work God has you doing.
Sure. Thanks again for having me, and it's great to be back with you guys. I office out of Brentwood, Tennessee, with the Center for Relational Healing, and I also do some distance counseling from my own home office as well. So I literally can wake up in Franklin, Tennessee in the morning and be in Israel by 3 p.m. in the afternoon, or in London, so it's actually pretty crazy, or in D.C., you know.
Yeah.
So it does take me around the world, and what I basically do, my background is marriage and family therapy, but I focus greatly on men, and now starting to get into working with women as well, but men who have unwanted same-sex attraction. So the therapy that I practice, I come from what's called a reparative approach, or reparative theory.
Okay.
Which basically holds that the origin of unwanted same-sex attraction or homosexuality is in unmet emotional and identification needs with the same gender. So it's men trying to still connect, attach, become part of that masculine community that they feel outside of.
Right.
So reparative therapy would suggest, and Elizabeth Moberly, I believe, is the counselor that years ago, several decades ago, coined this phrase, or the term, rather. The reparative approach looks at the homosexual drive as actually a positive drive. It's how it plays out that is positive, or that can go to a negative place, getting our needs met in an unhealthy way.
I see.
So, but the drive itself is basically the man's unconscious self saying, I don't belong, I don't feel like I belong, I want to be that. It's not necessarily they're saying that I want that, they're saying I want to be that.
And yeah.
They want to connect. It's finishing that belonging, or that connection or attachment to their gender, and feeling like one of the community of men.
Yeah, yeah. And this is a real common feeling. Even for guys who are fully engaged in heterosexual relationships, married guys, tons and tons of Christian guys. You know, I was so naive. I thought this is just, you know, a sliver of the population.
Well, yeah, I mean, just what you said a little while ago, the feedback on the first episode alone, the difference between your episode, that is, your first one, compared to the other topics that we've had.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, just that number right there should tell you, you know, where a lot of guys are having issues, you know, versus others. So,
okay.
I mean, just that alone.
Okay. So we've got a guy who he has a drive that he may feel very, very guilty about. He feels guilty just about the feeling, just about the drive. And he's got to keep that to himself, right?
Right, because it's too scary.
Yep.
They fear rejection. A man will fear being rejected by other men. if I share that I struggle with homosexuality.
Right. Yeah. And so then he may be wandering around with this sense of dread, waiting for the shoe to drop. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't know where his heart's going to take him. And he wonders what's wrong with him.
Mm-hmm.
What ideas do you have about the origins of same-sex attraction?
That's a great question. What I basically deal with when I'm working with a man, let me back up. A lot of people, you know, wonder, well, are you just talking about sex in your office, mm-hmm. sexuality? It's very rare that I have conversations with men about sex and homosexuality.
Yeah.
And sexual enactment in my office. I'm dealing with attachment issues and toxic shame issues with men.
Mm.
So attachment, which happens within the first few years of life with parents, with mother and father, is what will set us up if we attach in a healthy manner and in a good way, that will set us up for the rest of our life to attach well, to have healthy friendships, mm-hmm. Parent relationships, sibling relationships, friendships, romantic love relationships later on in life,
mm-hmm.
to attach poorly or even detach sets us up just the opposite for life. So that's where I've mentioned, I remember last time, defensive detachment,
mm-hmm.
or
mm-hmm.
malattunement. So a lot of men that struggle either with same-sex attraction or don't struggle necessarily with homosexuality, but as you said, struggle with even just connecting to masculinity and the community of men, are afraid to step toward men because there's an attachment that has to finish taking place. And the only way to do that is to step into it, is to move toward men. So most of the time I'm dealing with, no, not most of the time, all the time I'm dealing with attachment of men feeling rejection, feeling unloved, feeling like they have to do anything and everything to please you so that you will like them.
Yeah.
So it's a false self, mm-hmm. which, you know, I'm sure that's been talked about on other sessions.
Yeah,
false
sure.
self. And to show the real self isn't acceptable. Because
yeah.
they learned at a very young age that to be real, to be authentic, does not please mom and dad.
Mm.
Not all parents. I'm just talking about the issue of SSA. Sometimes that is an accurate perception by the child, and sometimes it's a misperception by the child.
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, they learn that it's not okay to be them, so instead they take a place of shame, and that's where the shame comes in.
Yeah.
That's where shame begins to develop. It's not okay to be me, so I have to be something else so that you will like me.
Uh-huh.
And if I do anything else, you will reject me, and then that will pour on more shame. Or if I share with you what I struggle with, you will reject me, and that will pour on more shame. So completely avoid being authentic.
Yeah.
So no one will reject me.
Yeah.
But then no one really knows me.
Yeah. What a hollow life that
mm-hmm.
is.
Yeah.
So it seems, I mean, it's important to note what you're saying is there's a big difference between someone who might struggle with unwanted alcohol abuse, which they see as something they do, mm-hmm. versus unwanted same-sex attraction, which it seems like that person usually feels like it's something they are. It seems like it's a bit of a difference in those types of situations where people mm-hmm. are dealing, struggling with feelings, that the identity seems a little more attached with this? Is that kind of what you're saying?
There's some truth to that, absolutely, Aaron. But with that said, if you were to, let's say, list out all of the characteristics of an alcoholic and all the characteristics mm-hmm. of a guy that struggles with SSA and all of the characteristics of a guy that deals with womanizing or heterosexual porn, mm-hmm.
right.
and then cover up the labels of those lists,
right.
you would see a lot of crossover. You would see a lot of the same issues going back to false self and attachment
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
brokenness, right? And so for this man, his way of medicating came through alcoholism.
Mm-hmm.
Through this man, his way of attaching to his gender or trying to absorb his gender and feel like one of them is through acting out homosexual. So
there's a lot of identity attachment that we're all doing that's attached with the wrong stuff in our life that we feel ashamed of and that we're attaching to.
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, you know, I've been thinking about this a lot lately. I hate saying that I'm a reparative therapist and that I deal with men who struggle with same-sex attraction. Mm-hmm. That's the second part is really what I hate, because reparative therapy looks at homosexuality or unwanted same-sex attraction as a symptom, not as a root issue. Mm. The root would be attachment and shame. I would much rather say I work with men who deal with attachment and shame issues.
Yeah.
However, how would anyone find me then that deals with same-sex attraction? Mm-hmm. So it's a necessary evil. The reason why I hate that so much is because it gives more power to the label of SSA, but SSA is a symptom, so it shouldn't even have the power of a label. So all that said, just to emphasize, I've had to settle for it. It's the only way people know how to find me that deal with this issue. But really, I want men to understand is this is not your identity. This is one aspect of your psychological makeup, but it's not all of who you are. What's really going on is we're trying to reattach to our gender, and we're trying to deal with toxic shame. It's not about same-sex attraction.
Wow.
So it seems like it really works. It must work against the guys that you're trying to help, that when they come to a place of honesty with the men around them, that many, I'll just speak for men inside the church, there are a lot of stereotypes and uncomfortable responses that they probably get that are emasculating when they're trying to step into. So what would you say to the men who are listening right now that they don't struggle with same-sex attraction and they're a little weirded out by it? Mm-hmm. And what would you say to them to help them be open to a man that needs to step into his true identity as a man?
I would invite that group of men that are the weirded out, as you say, or are uncomfortable, to educate themselves a bit, and hopefully today will help in that direction. But to also, I would ask them, what is it that you're so afraid of about this? You know, and to step into, to face those fears themselves, to ask yourself those questions. Why am I afraid? What am I afraid actually may happen if I let some of these men into my circle and get close? I believe that, I may have said this last time, I don't recall, but there's more than two groups, but basically there are two groups of men in the church when it deals with it, when we're talking about SSA. There are those that do struggle with this, there are those that do not. And the enemy has done an amazing job at keeping those two groups apart through fear, right? So what I tell men in my office, you need to go and seek out safe men that don't struggle with this issue. And they can be friends with the men that do as well, but they need men in their life that this isn't what they've struggled with. And they need to begin to move closer to them and have safe, intimate, healthy relationships with these guys. And but that being said, I need men in the church, we need men in the church that don't struggle with this, that are willing to also step into their fear and move toward these men.
Right.
The enemy has done a great job at keeping the two men separate, and it just perpetuates the problem.
Yeah.
And so you have two groups that are afraid to move toward each other, and if they did, there would be uncontrollable and powerful healing. Yeah. I believe that would happen. And what happens is, because I get men all the time that say, well, Thaddeus, I'm attracted to those guys. You know, there's even some sexual attraction there. And there's attraction, and part of that can be sexual attraction, but not all of it is sexual attraction. Mm-hmm. So they want to run from those men. Because, well, what happens if I become aroused or attracted around them? And what I tell them is, no, you have to move toward them and see what happens. And generally what happens after a while, they get to know men and they become connected and attached, the attraction goes away.
Yeah.
It diminishes.
Yeah.
And so the answer is actually stepping into and moving toward what we fear, not in running from it. It just, it's, you know, just like anything else.
You know, I remember in the evolution of our local Samson group here in Franklin, Tennessee, how wonderful it was when we got to this level. You know, in the beginning, when we were first meeting, some of our guys were doing that prototypical locker room thing where they're just making gay jokes. And it was part of the banter in the beginning of the meeting. And some of that joking was done by guys who did not experience same-sex attraction. Some of that joking was done defensively by guys who do struggle with it.
Mm-hmm.
But it became clear to us at one point, and I forget who raised the issue, but somebody did. May have been Bunker, who just said, we're making the room unsafe with these jokes. We're saying you're going to get ridiculed if you can identify at all with this thing. And so we agreed to outlaw gay jokes.
Right.
And then the day that the first man just stepped up and started talking about his you know, unwanted feelings, man, did the room become so much safer. And now it's a subject that we don't have to avoid in Samson.
Yeah. That sounds like something Bunk would bring up.
Yeah,
Bunker,
yeah. And I love watching the new guy come in, and some of those guys, you know, they're wondering, is this a safe topic? Can I go here? And to watch them light up when they find out that that's not something we have to talk around.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so if I'm able to bring up this topic. Well, first of all, if I'm struggling with this issue and I'm going to tell the jokes too, you're right, that's a defense, so you won't think that I struggle with same-sex attraction.
Right.
Again, which is different from identifying as a gay man.
Right.
And you can listen to Podcast 14 to find out all about that. But and then for the men, and this is going to be just a judgment on my part, and you all check your own hearts for this, but I would suggest that the men that are telling those jokes to begin with, yes, part of it goes back to childhood. That's how we joked around in the locker room. And part of it is, I think, also sending a message that, hey, what we're doing here in Samson is really healthy and intimate, and it means we've got to get close to each other as men, and we're sort of kind of not used to doing that as men.
Yeah.
And so I just want you to know that I don't struggle with this issue, so I'm going to joke about it to let you know.
Yeah.
And that will make my anxiety go down to put it on someone else who may be in this room that struggles with it. So it's all about lowering the anxiety level so you all know that we're good and we can be close, but we don't deal with this issue.
Right, yeah.
That's what my judgment would be. And, you know, we often use humor. We use any number of things to lower our anxiety.
Sure.
But it is. It becomes a much safer place, or rather it does become a much safer place when someone like a Bunker comes along and just names it and just calls it and speaks it out. And then we can all sort of kind of take a sigh of relief and say, all right, yeah, that sounds more accurate. And can we move on from this place?
I think of Jesus on the night that he was having the Last Supper. And there's the statement that all authority was given to him from heaven. And so he took off his robe, and then we get him washing the feet of the disciples. And it's always blown me away that because his identity was already set, he knew who he was before his father. He knew what authority he had. So he took off the garments of authority that anyone could have recognized. Oh, he's a rabbi. And he took that off. He didn't need the trappings of it. And when you're talking about the way we speak, I think there are so many ways that we as men are trying to put on the costumes so that we're known. Because we feel so insecure that we are not. Whereas Jesus was so the opposite, that when we get connected to the heart of the Father, we don't need by our jokes and by our words to be heaping on costumes so everybody recognizes us. We can take it off and actually serve and love each other.
Yeah.
So I think it's an amazing thing when we start to recognize how we do that, our own patterns of speech.
Yeah. That's a great question for us to pose to ourselves. What costume do I put on in the morning? How do I dress before I go to a Samson meeting?
Yeah, that's a very good question.
I'm hearing just through the grapevine, Thaddeus, wonderful stories of change and transformation. The men who have trusted you and spent time with you. What does change look like for somebody who launches into what can be this intimidating territory of reparative therapy?
That's a great question. Change, the way I define change in my office with men is change is different because every man is different. It's different for every man. So some men may come in, and I'll do a scaling question on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being I struggle with this through the roof, extreme, 1 being hardly at all, you know, 0 being not at all. Where do you set, just to sort of get an idea when we're starting? So we have something to measure against later when I ask that. And so I may have a guy say, well, I'm at an 8 or 9 with SSA, and toward other men, obviously. And they may diminish or rid themselves of SSA altogether, or they may diminish it to a 2 or a 3 and just be at peace because, well, men act out all kinds of ways. They may act out through pornography and masturbation in the privacy of their own home or hotel room. They may have anonymous encounters while traveling. There's all different ways. They may be acting out with men that they know. They may diminish. Change for that man may be, I'm at a 2 or 3 now. I'm not going crazy needing to act out all the time because now I'm getting my needs met with healthy, safe men. I feel like I belong. So, and they may want to marry and date women, and they might want to eventually marry and have a family. Some of them are already married, and so now they're walking in their marriage better. Some men, they'll diminish altogether, and they'll watch their opposite sex attraction or attraction to the feminine increase. We can do work around that as well, but it sort of naturally begins to occur with some men as the SSA decreases, the opposite sex becomes the mystery and just naturally begins to increase. Some men may get rid of it altogether. Some men may not want to marry, and so they're just happy that they're not acting out every day frantically, and they're at peace finally. So change... change is different, just as every man is different. And a big question that comes with that is, right from the beginning, men will ask, how long is this going to take? Well, I don't know. You know, so, you know, I work with clients that, man, they knock out what they need to do in about 9 months. And then I've been working for 2 years with some clients. It really depends upon the man. What they've involved themselves in life, you know, their attachment issues and to what degree and what levels. And then also, it depends also on the man's willingness to do the work, to do the hard work, just like in any therapy.
Sure.
And that can be very scary. So how long, I can never give a definite answer. It depends on, there's a lot of variables, and really it depends on the man stepping into the work. Sometimes men don't know what to do or are afraid to do anything, and there's a paralysis, and sometimes they expect me to do it for them, and I can't do that. So.
Right. You can be a guide, but they've got to do the work.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So what should somebody expect from himself if he embarks on this enterprise?
Just what I was saying, a man should expect to do their work, whatever that looks like. They should expect for their fear to come up, for anger to come up, for sadness.
They're going to have to face their feelings.
Absolutely. And because of defensive detachment and shame, a lot of men are actually, and this isn't just with SSA, of course, but a lot of men are shut down to their emotions.
Right.
So I get all different kinds of men as far as emotions go as well. Some men are completely detached from their bodies. I call it they live outside of themselves. They only live in their head.
Yeah.
And so then first we would need to get them back into their bodies and feeling and connecting with their emotions. And so that can be very difficult, and that's okay. As long, I just always encourage, hey, it's okay. As long as you're open to feeling, to even sensing physiological sensations in your body when something's happening, that's just showing that, hey, I'm starting to pay attention to my body. I'm starting to pay attention. Emotions are coming back. Because for so long, these particular men, or some of these men, it was not okay to be sad as a kid or to be angry. You know, don't you cry or I'll give you something to cry about.
Right.
Or don't you raise your voice to me. And sometimes as kids, it's just a child is angry. Mm-hmm. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're being defiant.
Right.
And so they need to be able to be allowed to express anger or sadness if they're sad or fear if they're fear.
Right.
And so a lot of these men were not. It was not okay. So they suppressed everything.
Right.
So they should be expecting a man starting to step into this work that we're going to get connected back to your body, back to your emotions. We're going to start stepping into your fears. And you should expect to be challenged and to do your work and that the counselor can't do the work for you.
This sounds like core recovery work, the same kind of stuff that we do.
Absolutely.
AA and SA mm-hmm. and Al-Anon and any of us whose lives have been ravaged by addiction and finally reached the point where we're ready to move. We're either going to die or we're going to live, and we're going to need help learning how to live. These are exactly the kind of things that we talk about.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Wow. Mm.
That's why I said earlier, you know, addressing one of Aaron's questions, you know, put out the different forms of brokenness and put all the characteristics on each list, cover up the labels, and you're going to get crossover. You're going to see...
Because what you just described as being that therapy, I immediately don't picture that being a need for an SSA guy. I picture it as being the need for the manly man jock guy that has been so disconnected from anything he feels. Probably, we all need to walk through this. I mean, we've seen, you know, guys do this work... from every type of brokenness, and so that that is a great, that's great the way you just described it. I think you've illustrated your point beautifully.
And to take it a step further, that's why I said in the beginning, I rarely talk about sex in my office. There are times where I have to, because if a man's acting out, okay, let's look at that. You know, what's going on there? What needs are you getting met? So definitely there are times where I might do a psychoeducation piece around sex, or I might do what's called a preceding scenario. What led up to this? How did we get here? But I'm not having conversations about sexual enactment in my office. I'm dealing with attachment and shame. I had someone recently from a place of anger ask me, you know, that would hold an opposite point of view, that doesn't approve of reparative therapy. I recently say to me, you know, so, you know, you sit here and you tell men that they should change their sexual orientation, and you help men change their sexual orientation. I said, actually, no, that's not what I do. I help men with depression and anxiety and attachment and shame, and in doing so, by them doing their work, their same-sex attraction diminishes. No. You deal with... You change men's sexual orientation. No, that's not actually what I do.
Yeah.
I help men, and we went back and forth several times. Uh-huh. And so it wasn't just me trying to be political and you know, try and dance around the issue. I really don't talk that much about sex in my office, so, or orientation for that matter.
Wow, I can see that this approach really helping the guy who struggles with rage. That's a big percentage of our Samson guys, by the way. It may even be their number one medicator when they're feeling, you know, out of control. The way to get control is to go to rage. And that's a tough thing to admit. Thank you so much, Thaddeus, for kind of demystifying this thing. You got any more questions for Aaron? Aaron, you got any more questions for Thaddeus before we let him go?
You know, that we could do this discussion for days, I think. So that was a good spot to end.
All right.
But I would...
I think we're going to have to...
How many episodes ago did you come? Because we can do it again. You can be the first Triple Crown winner.
Yeah, let's start negotiations with his agent and see if we can get
him.
Yeah,
we need to bring him back, man.
Yeah,
price goes up by the hour, so.
Does it really?
Well, never mind.
Well, can't thank you.
With that said, we're coming up to the top of the hour. Thaddeus has to go before he bills us overtime for being here. It was really nice having you here. We'll talk to you later. That's the end of the podcast. Goodbye.
And we will be back on the Pirate Monk Podcast.
Oh, a pirate's life is a wonderful life, a roving over the sea. Give me a career as a buccaneer, it's the life of a pirate for me. Oh, the life of a pirate for me.
And we're back. It's always great to have Thaddeus with us, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. He's great, man.
I like Thaddeus.
I don't know anybody who doesn't like Thaddeus.
Yeah.
And he sure has been an enormous help to Allie and me, to so many of our friends here in Franklin, and the guys around the world. Look forward to having him on again in another 9 months. Okay, well, we're coming down to the end of this show. We should let everybody know that there are some 48 Hours events coming up. Mm-hmm. We have been talking about the Pastor's 48 Hours at the end of this month, the end of January, in Southern California, up in the San Bernardino Mountains. You can get all the information you need about that one on the front page, the pub page, SamsonSociety.net. And also, first weekend in February, one in Palatka. There's a team of guys led by Rob Brown, very experienced guys in the leadership of 48 Hours Weekends, who are setting up a tour for 2011. This is exciting. This is top shelf stuff. They're booking them into lodges, great venues. A first-class weekend, but let me warn you in advance, an intensive spiritual experience. You want to really get rolling on your recovery. You need a boost. You want somebody to walk with you through all seven stages of the path in 48 hours, then you're going to want to get yourself to a 48 Hours of Frankness weekend. Now, they've just announced the first three dates on that tour. The 48 Hours Atlanta is going to be March 25th and 26th. 48 Hours Austin, San Antonio, Texas is going to be April 8th and 9th. And 48 Hours Orlando the following weekend, April 15th and 16th. You'll be able to get information on these weekends, too, on the pub page, the main page at SamsonSociety.net. And, of course, we love to hear from you. You can reach us anytime via the worldwide interweb by sending an email our way at samsonpodcast@gmail.com.
Yep.
That's samsonpodcast@gmail.com. Or you can mail us. And trust your communication to the hands of the United States Postal Service and address it as follows. Samson's Pirate Monk Podcast, Box 224, Franklin, Tennessee, 37065.
Yeah, and you know what? It might be good to get some feedback on the mini meeting, or even suggestions of topics.
Oh, I love that! Yeah, tell us what you think of the new segment. Is it a keeper, or should we can it?
Yeah.
Or let us know anything else that's on your mind. We'd love to hear from you. Looks like that's it for this week, Aaron. I'll see you next week. So long, Mondo.
Oh, yeah.
And to all our listeners, we'll talk to you next week here on the Pirate Monk Podcast.
Take your day by day. Say, whoa, 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 whoa. shame.